So we come to our Lenten season, and during Lent we'll be looking at a series of ideas all prompted by the letter D. And so today it's D for definition. And taking completely out of context a verse that we just heard, the reading, the heart of it, the question posed was, what is your name? What is your name? Because if there is anything that defines us, it is a name. We are given a name. We may not like it, because none of us had a choice in the matter. Our parents chose for us. Some parents chose wisely, and some barely gave it a thought. And when we grew up, we began to realize whether we had wise parents or not. Usually when you first went to school and the teacher began going around the classroom and asking all of us to give out our full names. And some just came and went, and others saw eyebrows raised and much laughter, much embarrassment. What is your name? We don't want to be a number. We have plenty of numbers to define us, but we don't want to be a number. We want to have a name. Now, our traditions, we're not that liturgically minded, but still, Lent gives us an opportunity to revisit the scriptural account of Jesus' last journey toward Jerusalem, ultimately the cross and the resurrection. And that journey begins at Caesarea Philippi, where he meets with the disciples and he's asking them questions. And he asks of the disciples, who is it that people say that I am? What label do they want to pin on me? What name will they give me? And the disciples pluck out of the air some names. Some say you are the prophet Elijah. Come back. Elijah, who had been delivered from the earth miraculously and whom it was thought would be a precursor to the coming of the Messiah. Perhaps you are Elijah. Others think you are John the Baptist, the rabble-rouser recently executed for going that bit too far in his condemnation of the ruling family. Some people think you're John the Baptist, come back to life. And others say, well, you're one of the prophets. Any number of labels people were prepared to pin on Jesus. He was having an impression, and people were responding. And then he turns to the disciples and says, okay, that's fine, but who do you say that I am? Who do you think that I am? This was to be a defining moment as far as Jesus' ministry was concerned, both for him and for the disciples. And such moments work at any level. Because if we're honest, there are times when all of us wonder how we are seen by the wider world. Who do people say we are? What label would they pin on us? We might from time to time ask it of our closest friends, family, and so on. What sort of impression am I creating? How am I coming across? Who am I to you? Simon, speaking for himself or for them all, we don't know. Simon replies, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Some label, some name. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus appears to accept this response as genuine. He commends Simon, telling him that such a confession could only have been prompted by the Spirit of God acting within him. But then, subsequently, Jesus goes on to describe what inevitably has to happen to him if he really is whom Simon says he is. He's going to suffer. Chief priests will take him. He will be arrested. Ultimately, he will die and then be raised to life on the third day. This is what must happen inevitably to the Christ of God, whom Simon has recognized Jesus to be. And at this, Simon responds angrily. "This shall never be," he said. And at that point, Jesus realizes that Simon's confession may not have been what it appeared to be. Rather than an honest, heartfelt response revealing exactly how Simon felt, might it have been Simon telling Jesus what he thought Jesus wanted to hear? We've all fallen foul of that on either side of the equation. Being told by others what they think we want to hear. Being prepared to tell others what we think they want to hear from us. It is all too easy for those closest to us to tell us what they think we want to hear. We ask them the question, they wonder how we might answer it for ourselves, and then they parrot that answer back to us. And what's true for us as individuals is also true for the church, whether it be the whole Christian church or an individual congregation such as ours. If truth be known, as far as wider society is concerned, church is not that highly regarded. We can't fool ourselves otherwise. Whether it matters or not is another question. But we have to be honest. A succession of scandals, especially in regard to clergy sex abuse, has done untold harm to the church's reputation. So if we go into the wider world and canvass opinion about the church, we need to be prepared for some unwelcome responses. And even if we ourselves are directly untouched by such activity, guilt by association is often assumed. You're all the same. If it's going on there, it must be going on here, and so on. And even if there is no specific allegation to lay at the door, we find church so often condemned far more savagely by the polite indifference of those who would walk past. We are forever being damned with faint praise. Too often people will say to us, "Thanks, but no thanks." Who do people say that we are? That's what we're working with. But in spite of all of this, there will be those, either at arm's length or up close, who will be prepared to speak positively on behalf of the church and of the contribution for good which the church has meant for them in their lives. And we thank God for such people, and we thank God for continuing evidence of God's work amongst people which draws out such responses. But the Lenten discipline, rather than going beyond this, demands that we take a close look at ourselves as individuals. Not so much how do others define us, but how do we define ourselves? Lent dares us to engage in what some call, in business circles, self-appraisal. Not so much in terms of what am I, rather, given what I am, how do I measure up? And because it is Lent, this self-appraisal becomes a guided self-appraisal. How do I measure up as far as God is concerned? In particular, as far as the God who is revealed in Jesus is concerned. And if we are honest, the outcome should be, at best, uncomfortable. There's a sense in which Jesus was brutal in his treatment of Simon. "Get behind me, Satan. You've been prompted by the devil to say what you did." No more harsher criticism could be laid at Simon's door than that. He thought he was confessing Christ to be the Messiah. But no, Jesus says to him, "You're prompted by the devil." How brutal. Yet, there's a sense in which how many of us would have responded differently. To hear Jesus say to us that as a consequence I have to suffer and die, our immediate response is bound to be, "Not on my watch. I wouldn't let that happen to you. You're too precious. I'd do anything, even give my own life for yours. That's how precious you are to me. That's how much you mean to me. I will not let this happen." Would any of us stand by and let the Son of the Living God be treated in the way Jesus described? And of course, fast forward to Gethsemane. On the night of Jesus' arrest, the mob come. There is Jesus and the disciples quietly in the garden, and there they are. And who's in the front line defending Jesus? It's Simon, now called Peter. And out comes his sword. And off comes the ear of the high priest's servant. He would do anything to prevent Jesus being arrested. They're not going to take him. He's far too precious to Simon. Simon's not going to let him go in this way. And Jesus turns to him and says, "Put your sword away." He heals the servant of the high priest and allows himself to be taken away to arrest and trial. This guided self-appraisal of which we speak, for Simon, it would have to wait until after the resurrection, when we are told there was breakfast on the beach, when the risen Christ comes to guide him through a self-appraisal that would shape the whole of the rest of his life. The description of that encounter is to me the most poignant of all the passages in the Bible. Why? Because I am there too. Why? Because I have to be there. I cannot avoid being there. It is the place to which all of us must come. It is the conversation we all have to have. Way back, as it might have seemed, at Caesarea Philippi, Jesus had asked, "Who do you say that I am?" Now Jesus asks, "Do you love me more than these?" Who do you say that I am? Do you love me more than these? In terms of a guided self-appraisal, neither question is that easy to answer, but the second is far more difficult. But each of us has to answer for ourselves, because how we answer will be a defining moment for us all.